BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. Today is Thursday, July 19th, 2012, and this is podcast number 172. There's going to be a picnic in celebration of the freedom of voluntary exchange, and this is going to happen in Washington, D.C., 3rd Street Southwest between Maryland and Jefferson near the Capitol Reflecting Pool in Washington, D.C. And if you're anywhere in that area on August 18th, 2012, I want to really urge you to get down there to the Reflecting Pool, to the area around the Reflecting Pool there, and you'll see the folks gathering together. Join the folks with Raw Milk Freedom Riders and Lemonade Freedom Day. And go over there and have some fun, exchange some food, bring a picnic lunch or something to share. You know, it doesn't have to be a big deal. Stop by and grab a bucket of chicken or something. It doesn't matter what, but take something down there to share and exchange it freely with other people in a voluntary exchange and have fun. And hopefully this will be a peaceful thing. Hopefully the government will not, you know, stomp in and try to make a big deal about it. If they do, there will be a lot of cameras watching, and, you know, I used to have a friend that used to say, if nobody starts anything, nothing will get started. And he meant that in a very violent way. Actually, he used words that were slightly different than that, but he meant that in a very violent way. In other words, this guy would sit peaceably for the rest of his life, and not one drop of aggression would ever come out of him unless someone crossed his path in a way that he felt that he had been aggressed upon, and in which case all gloves were off, all rules were set aside, and there was a real problem. And that's the way this guy lived his life. And in a sense, and then in the other way, it's like, well, if nobody starts anything, then nothing will get started. Well, the flip side of that coin is that if you don't stand up to the government on some things, then it'll just keep getting worse and worse and worse and worse. Now, if you're a regular listener to BadQuaker.com podcast, you know that I thoroughly believe that the state will get worse, the state will become more oppressive, governments of the world will reach out and steal as much as they can, as much as they can get away with. They will continue to oppress in every way that they possibly can. The difference in these two things, and it's important to understand the balance here, is if the government can only do what we allow it to do. I've talked before about the, you know, imagining the state as a dragon, and it's covered head to toe with scales. And anybody who knows anything about mythology any of those, that type of thought, knows that a dragon's scales are extremely hard, and you can't, like, shoot an arrow through it, or you can't stab it with a spear, or you can't stab it with a sword, or whatever. So this is the image of the dragon in our the Western idea of the dragon that we have in our minds when we think of this. And the state is very much like a dragon like that. It likes to hoard gold. It likes to dominate people. It breathes fire. Death is nothing to it. It almost finds entertainment in death. But the difference with the state is that this is all imagery. Really, if you get up close to the state and you really look, it's all a myth. It's all pretend. And those things that you think are scales are actually images. They're little bandages. And they're covering a wound underneath. They're covering raw flesh underneath. And it's not really an impenetrable shield-like scale. It's really more like a little piece of paper with the image of a scale on it. It's really like more like a bandage, like a Band-Aid or some type of a bandage with the image of a scale. So that when you look at it, it looks like it's an impenetrable shield. But when you grab a hold of that dude and you yank it off, there's nothing but raw flesh underneath it. There is nothing really protecting the state except the myth of the state. And the state is going to aggress using governments of the world, using the banking system, using the mainstream media, using corporations. The state is going to aggress upon us in every possible way that we allow it. And it's going to continue to consume as much as it can until it gets so bloated that those producing actual wealth in the world can no longer feed this thing. And then at some point, it's kind of like that one scene in the Monty Python movie. Which movie was that? Anyway, there's a scene where a man is in a restaurant and he's just completely eaten so much that he can't hold anymore. And one of the Monty Python characters says, "No, just have just one more little. It's a thin mint. Just have a thin mint after your dinner. It's very thin. It's just a little thin mint. It's wafer thin." And the guy eats it, and then that's the last straw, and he explodes, and splatters all over the restaurant. And of course, it's a horrible thing to imagine in your mind, and it's a pretty grotesque scene in the movie, but. Comparing this to the state will continue to consume as much as it can until it explodes or implodes. Actually, it will fall in upon itself. And when it does, it's going to just make a horrible mess among those that are nearby who serve it. But at the same time, and I believe all that stuff, but at the same time, while the state is growing and while it is becoming more and more oppressive on every level and so forth like this, when we see something that we can fight for and that we can show people this is the true nature of the state, if we can do that without bringing great harm to ourselves or to our cause, to our movement, then it's always profitable to shine that light on the state, to pull that one scale off the state and show the raw flesh underneath and the vulnerabilities of this beast. Now, I've used this metaphor before, and I've said the problem is if you stand there and keep yanking off those bandages, eventually the state's going to notice you, and when the state notices you, it will crush you like a bug, because that's what the state does. It has no compassion, has no feeling. It might use the government to crush you. It might use the media. It might use banking. It might use any of its many tools. But all of its tools ultimately are in the shape of a hammer, and they just crush you. Or like Stefan Molyneux always says, it's the gun in the room. It's the gun pointed at your face. But the fact is that if you can get up there and just yank off one little scale, just pull that dude off, just like that. And lots of times you can do this without drawing the full attention of the state. In cases like that, you can do a tremendous service to the liberty movement. And little things like raw milk. I talked yesterday about actually how important milk is to humans. But in this argument, in this debate about state or no state and states' rights and you know, individual liberty and the Constitution and all these things that get kicked around in the liberty movement, if you can show that even on these little things like lemonade stands, hot dog stands, kids making a little side money, these cases where people have been attacked by their city governments because they had a treehouse in their yard, you know, things like this, growing tomatoes in your yard, and you end up having the government in your face over it. One lady, I guess it was about a year ago, a lady that was suffering cancer and was trying to have a yard sale to try to pay for some of her medical expenses. And the city officials come down on her and just make a big fuss about it. Things like this, if you can show people it's not just who's president, it's not just those 500 and some thugs in Washington, D.C. that make up what we call, you know, the government. It's not just the government. It's not just Parliament in the country you may be in, or it's not just those clowns in the Capitol. It's not just them. That's not the problem. The problem is this dragon, and it's much bigger than any particular government. It's this idea that some human beings can rightfully rule over other human beings, that some human beings have one set of laws that applies to them, and then they make up laws that apply to you. This idea, that is the state, and it is extremely vulnerable. And if we can show tiny little aspects of it without gaining its attention, without causing it to bring its stare down upon us, because that's the other thing with the dragon in mythology and so forth. If the dragon ever locks eyes on you, you're gone. If you ever engage the dragon in verbal confrontation, you're gone. It wins. The moment the dragon fully puts his attention upon you, you lose. So to be able to go and yank off a scale, lemonade, boom, look at this. The government wants to control whether your kids can have a lemonade stand. Now, that's powerful. The government wants to tell you whether or not you can drink a certain kind of milk, or whether you can transport that milk, or whether you can buy and sell that milk. That's powerful. A lot of people, you know, you think, well, what about the important things? Like, they have drones now that can fly around and look in your backyard and look through your window. There's vans that drive around and that can actually scope right through the walls of your house and look into your house. These vans drive around and just randomly scan people on the streets. If you're not sure about this, you don't think this is not Alex Jones crazy stuff. This is all very well established. This is not, you know, new world orders coming to get us and black helicopters are whisking us away silently. No, this stuff is really happening. The governments really are doing these things. But if you try to attack the dragon like that, then you will very quickly come under its attention. If you try to, you know, I hear people all the time talking about actually taking up arms against the government. And if you do that, you have played directly into the hands of the government. There's nothing the government knows how to do any better than crush some gun nut. That's exactly what it can do. And it can do that with full public support. And they'll make you out to be the bad guy. But how can they make you out to be the bad guy if you're just selling lemonade? Or if you're just selling, or if you're just exchanging raw milk? How can you be the bad guy? So, August 18th, 2012, 12 p.m., noon, that's a Saturday, 3rd Street Southwest between Maryland and Jefferson near the Capitol Reflecting Pool in Washington, D.C. If you can be there, take something down to exchange and have some fun, some peaceful fun. And let's yank another one of these scales off this dragon. Now, I want to jump over to a different thing as well. Longtime listeners may have noticed that there's a lack of Baggy and a lack of Nikki in the newer podcasts. And newer podcast listeners are saying, what in the world is Ben talking about? Well, within the house, outside the house, I have two dogs. They're my outside the boys, I call them, and they control the grounds. But inside the house, we have a little dog, very tiny little dog named Nikki, and she's a good little girl. And we have Baggy the cat, and Baggy the cat is a somewhat psychotic, unpredictable cat, like they all are. And when I first started doing the podcast for almost a year, one or the other of them always figured out a way to interrupt the podcast in some way. And as time went on, they both got more and more accustomed to the podcast happening, and it, you know, it was less of a big deal. They didn't have to have my attention constantly, so, you know. But that might have sort of changed today, and we'll see as this podcast progresses. Baggy had a very special event today. She likes to go out in the garage and hang around in the garage. She does this several times a day. She climbs around up into the shelves and up onto the overhead areas, and she climbs on top of... We have a refrigerator and a freezer in the garage in addition to the other refrigerators and freezers that we have here at the badquaker.com compound. Anyway, so she likes to climb around on top of them and goof around and things. So every once in a while she'll see a mouse out there, but she has very little chance of ever catching one because she's just not that bright. And, you know, occasionally I put out mouse traps and try to get the bring the mouse population down a little bit. But today she was in the garage, and what we do is when she goes in the garage, of course, all the exterior doors are closed because she's not an outside cat. She would not make, she would not do well outside in the out, you know, out in the environment. So we close the outer, all the outside doors to the garage, and we open the door between the kitchen and the garage and let her go out there. And then we just push the door closed, but it doesn't latch, so she can push it and open it back up and come back in. So today, this morning, she was out there in her garage doing her thing like she likes to do. She has a, you know, she has a litter box out there, and she has places she likes to lay and special boxes she likes to climb in and things. And I was preparing for the podcast here. I was getting my microphones all set up and everything. And in comes Baggy the cat, walking right up to my desk and with a mouse in her mouth, and drops the mouse in front of me. And, of course, the mouse was still alive. It was wounded pretty severely, but it was still alive. So it took off running, and she went after it. And my initial response to this, anyone who knows me or anyone who's been around me very much knows that I always have multiple blades of some kind within reach, no matter what the circumstances are. And that's just a thing that is natural to me. In and around my house, I have lots of bayonets, machetes, and blades of different kinds around in different places. Hatchets, axes, a variety of different blades, pretty much. Anywhere in my house, I like to have a powerful blade within a step or two of reach of me. And so when Baggy brought this mouse in and dropped it on the floor in front of me, and it took off running and she went after it, my initial reaction before I even thought about it was to grab a bayonet and skewer it. Now, she didn't appreciate this too much. She didn't like me stabbing, killing, and hauling her toy away. I skewered it with a bayonet, put it into the trash immediately, sealed the bag up, and took it outside. And she didn't like that at all. So she spent literally an hour and a half complaining to me about this. And I haven't been able to get the podcast started because I'm dealing with her meowing in my face and climbing around and batting at things, showing me her displeasure with the fact that I stole her toy, that I killed her toy in front of her, and then, you know, stole it, took it away. She didn't appreciate that very much. So I'm halfway expecting. She's distracted at the moment. I think she went back to her litter box, but I'm expecting at any particular time in this podcast for her to return and begin complaining to me again about stealing her mouse. So Baggy is now officially a mouser. She's several years old. I'm not sure exactly how old she is. Probably, 4 or 5 years old, something like that. And this is her very first mouse kill. So Baggy is now officially a mouser. And I hope I didn't disrupt her learning curve too awful bad. If I had thought about it for a moment, I probably would have tried to move her away and distract her so she didn't actually see me, kill the mouse. But it's kind of my reaction on things like that is not. I don't necessarily think what I'm doing. I just, grab a bayonet and thrust, and that's kind of how I do. It is interesting though, if we can call Baggy, if Baggy is now a mouser, the bayonet that I skewered the mouse with was from a Mauser. So it was a Mauser bayonet, and Baggy is a mouser. So anyway, I guess that's probably not why people tune in to this podcast. So I should probably break for a commercial and then, you know, get on to an actual topic that's not a cat and a mouse and milk. Okay, I'll be right back. Folks, I want to talk to you about Survival Gear Bags. Survival Gear Bags is about more than just great gear bags and survival kits. Check out their website by clicking the banner at badquaker.com. Survival Gear Bags has everything from Wise food storage products to tactical equipment to camping supplies to clothing and rain gear to hydration and purification systems to books and DVDs. Plus, Survival Gear Bags is known for its service, and it's owned and operated by people who understand and adhere to the zero aggression principle. So get over to Survival Gear Bags and get the stuff you need. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. And now I'll see if I can get to a real topic here. I was, I've mentioned before how much I enjoy picking on Jack Hunter, the Southern Avenger. He's a real, you know, if I can say some positive things about Jack Hunter, he is a very good conservative with strong libertarian leanings. I enjoy his videos. I enjoy listening to him. I enjoy watching him. He's a fun person. He's got a good sharp intellect. He's really interesting, and he's dead wrong on a lot of things too. But that's beside the point. You know, that's why I poke at him, because he is such a, I mean, it seems like he's a good guy. It's just some fundamental things that he's really confused about, and he's stuck in this Republican statist world where everything revolves around, you know, essentially trusting the idea that government can fix government. And if it weren't for that, I think you'd make a pretty good guy. It's just, you know, that's like saying, well, Al Capone, you know, if it wasn't for the fact that he hired people to kill people and you know, he'd be a pretty good guy if you just took out the murder part of it. Well, that's kind of the way it is with all statists. If you can take out that violent tendency towards aggression, which is what statism is, if you could just get them really to stop and look at that and realize that what they're what they're doing and saying is deeply immoral. If you can get them to look at that, then maybe at least the honest ones, maybe they'll abandon their aggression and abandon their statism. And I don't know. I don't have a lot of hope for Jack Hunter, because he has invested so much of himself in being a statist, that I'm not really sure that he's ever going to really self-examine and see beyond that. But I do poke at him now and then because he doesn't react violent when you poke at him. He is still cheerful. He has a good attitude. He's never really been harsh with me at all when I've taken jabs at him on the internet. So I don't know. Maybe it's unfair of me to poke him like that, but I think I'm going to go ahead and keep doing it. So Jack last night on Facebook put up this statement that he was going to go attend there was a debate between members of the Cato Institute and members of the Heritage Foundation, and he's going to go attend that debate. And interestingly enough, if I get the opportunity, I want to download the recording of that and listen to it myself, because it's probably pretty interesting. But Jack made the comment that he's going to get a kick out of listening to people argue about who won, afterwards. And he's going to, and then he said, like, if there's really a difference, you know, between conservatives and libertarians. He didn't actually say he was watching the Cato Institute debate the Heritage Foundation. He said he was watching a libertarian and a conservative debating, and then he made the statement that there's really no difference. They're really the same thing, and that's the problem with Jack. You see, he actually believes that, and the reason he and lots of conservatives with libertarian leanings, lots of conservatives actually think that's the truth. There's one of the memes that floats around on the internet shows sort of a hippie with holding something or other. It's kind of hard to tell what he's holding, but it's obviously some kind of a pipe device or a bong or whatever. And it says, libertarians are Republicans that own a bong. And I think a lot of conservatives believe that. A lot of conservatives believe that the only difference between libertarians and conservatives is that libertarians have some of these goofy leftist ideas, or that they're dopers or something like this. And this is entirely wrong, and I don't care who says it, and I will debate that with anybody under any circumstances, because that's not what a libertarian is. That's what conservatives who have libertarian leanings think. And many people call themselves libertarians, especially since around 2006 or 2008, when it became the fad. A lot of Republicans and conservatives got the idea that they were libertarians because of the failures of George W. Bush. Well, George W. Bush wasn't a conservative, first off. George W. Bush, I'm saying it again, was not a conservative. He's a neocon. Much like Barack Obama is not a liberal. Barack Obama is not even a communist. A lot of these people say these things about Barack Obama, but he's not a liberal, he's not a communist, he's a neocon. There's virtually no difference between George W. Bush and Mitt Romney and Barack Obama and John McCain. There's virtually no difference in these people. And this is what confuses conservatives, because they look at somebody like George W. Bush, when they can do so with a clear mind. For some reason, these people have a tendency to fog the mind of conservatives pretty quickly. But the true conservative can look at somebody like George W. Bush and look at the actions that he was doing, look at how he was destroying ammunition and destroying AK-47s to keep them from coming to the U.S. He was never he's never been pro-gun. So, when an honest conservative looks at that, and an honest conservative looks at the way he expanded government and interfered with Medicare and interfered with the No Child Left Behind, pushing public schools even more toward a socialist system than they already were, which is amazing. When real conservatives see that, they see flaws. And so they get confused and they think, well, maybe I'm not a conservative. Maybe I'm a libertarian. No, you're wrong. You're not a libertarian. Stop calling yourself a libertarian when you don't even know what it is. Stop calling yourself a libertarian because you agree with a couple libertarian points. This is not what a libertarian is. A libertarian is a person who embraces the zero aggression principle. And it's really that simple. Property rights, zero aggression principle. And the two, one can't exist without the other, and the two together produce liberty. Now, I'm not saying that to be harsh and to exclude people from the club. I'm saying that because it's true. And you have to be able to embrace the truth if you're ever going to move forward in any kind of fashion. You can't live your life lying to yourself and saying, I really am a bird. I really can fly. Well, let's see you fly. I don't have to prove anything to you. I'm a bird. I can fly, but I don't have to prove anything to you. Well, you're living a lie, aren't you? And that's what happens when a conservative adopts a couple of libertarian-leaning positions and then starts calling themselves a libertarian. It's the same thing as a person who claims they can fly. You need to face reality. Now, let me try to get back to my notes here, because I was really wandering off into Wonderland there. Let's examine this Cato Institution Heritage Foundation thing. Oh no, you know what? Let me get back to slapping around Jack Hunter a little bit. Jack fancies himself a libertarian, and then he says that there's no difference, or virtually no difference, between a libertarian and a conservative. Well, if you're hanging around the Cato Institute and you're hanging around the Heritage Foundation, there's very little difference between those two. There's nuances between the two, but honestly, there's very little difference. They're both violent. They're both aggressive. They both want to use the government to accomplish the things that they want to accomplish. They both want to reduce taxes, but not eliminate taxes. They want to reduce government, but they don't want to eliminate government. They talk about things like the Constitution, but they don't want to really face the true history of the way it was put together and what the motives were of those so-called founding fathers. They don't really want to look at that. So, what's really the difference between these people at the Cato Institute who call themselves libertarian and these people at the Heritage Foundation who, you might say, are conservatives, or at least right wing, if not true conservatives. I'm sure there's neocons at the Heritage Foundation as well. I don't follow them that closely. So in a sense, Jack's right. There's very little difference between the Cato Institute so-called libertarians and the Heritage Foundation so-called conservatives. But that's not what libertarians are. As a matter of fact, if you look at those people who call themselves libertarians who are actually conservatives, and you look at people who call themselves conservatives, and you look at the liberals, and you look at people who call themselves Democrats, and people who call themselves Republicans, and you look at people who call themselves part of the Green Party, or part of the Libertarian Party, you look at all these people, and they tend to have one thing in common. They want to continue using the aggression of government to dominate people and get the things done that they want to do. Well, that's not the zero aggression principle. The difference in all of those people and a true libertarian is that deep in his heart, the libertarian just wants to be left alone. That's all he wants. He doesn't want to order other people around, and he doesn't want people ordering him around. That's the simplicity of the libertarian. He may not have all of his theories correct. He may not have every aspect of his life following the zero aggression principle. He may not understand all the nuances of Austrian economics. He may not understand everything he needs to know about property rights. But the libertarian wants to be left alone, and he's willing to leave other people alone in order to achieve that. And I think there's a lot more libertarians than most people realize. But they're not in the Libertarian Party, and they're not at the Cato Institute, and they're not out there pushing for Ron Paul to be elected for president. People who deep inside want to be left alone, and they're willing to leave other people alone in order to achieve that, I think they're out there non-voting, just trying to make a living, just trying to, you know, make their way through life. And I think there's lots of them. They just want to be left alone. In the 1800s in North America, there were lots of people who just want to be left alone. And as the government would creep out further and further into the countryside, away from the cities, and would engulf, you know, area after area, first with organizing into counties, and then the people from the county coming out and organizing this and organizing that. More and more of these people just moved further west. And the whole point in that, now sure, there were some gold rushes, and there were some silver rushes, and there was some copper rushes, and there were economic motivations for people to move west and try to set up towns and so forth. But your stereotypical pioneer, that person you think of in your mind, that just loads everything that he owns, or everything that's important to him, he loads it into a wagon, and he gets himself a couple oxen, and a milk cow, you know, and a few things like that, gets them all together, a couple of chickens, and he goes marching across the prairie to try to find a place that he can call his own. That guy, that family, that group, that's libertarian. They just want to be left alone. There's a old thing, and it's often misunderstood, but there's an old thing where they would say, well, when the settlers would pull up and become pioneers and move out west, they would burn their cabins down and to get the nails out of the cabin, because the cabin was just made of wood, and there's lots of forests and so forth, but the nails were valuable. And this is a misunderstanding of history, and this is why revisionist history is so important. Let me compare this to something. If you've ever read Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, Steinbeck was a communist. He, philosophically speaking, he was a communist. And when he went and spent time with the Okies that were, leaving Oklahoma and trying to get into, trying to get a new life in California, he spent time with them trying to understand them and trying to, you know, see their view and their perspective. But in doing so, everything he saw was through his own communist eyes. So he, whether consciously or not, he projected upon them his communist opinions and his communist thoughts. And in doing so, he painted pretty much all Okies of the Great Depression, he painted them as communists. And that's just not accurate. But 200 years from now, when people read Steinbeck's stuff, they will be saying, well, he was a first-hand witness, and therefore this must be true. And it doesn't matter that he had a very well-known political agenda in writing Grapes of Wrath. That's beside the point. In the future, historians will look back at Steinbeck as a first-person witness, and they'll believe what he wrote. No matter that it's propaganda, they will believe what he wrote by sheer fact that he wrote it. And here's an example. Steinbeck in The Grapes of Wrath describes something that he called, it escapes me for the moment, but he described how the people from Oklahoma, the poor people, the poor farmers and the poor sharecroppers, he said that they chewed their food with their front teeth. Oh, I remember what he said. He said, as was the custom among them. And when I first read that, I thought, Steinbeck, you're an idiot. You are really stupid. People don't chew food with their front teeth because it's their custom. They chew food with their front teeth because they're extremely poor and they've had bad nutrition all their life and they don't have any back teeth. And anybody who's spent very much time in Appalachia ought to know this. But, of course, you know, he was dealing with people from Oklahoma, and he was he was not one of them. And he was an outside observer making an assumption about something without actually knowing the facts involved. But yet, when history is written hundreds of years from now, that's going to be written as a fact. It's going to be, somebody's going to pick that up as, oh yes, these unique people from Oklahoma ate their food with their front teeth because it was their custom. No. It's because they didn't have back teeth. Or their back teeth were so damaged that trying to chew with them, was painful. Or they would have problems, you know, trying to remove food from their broken teeth. I know that for a fact. People have heard me talking about my headaches and how I've gritted my teeth and broke teeth because of the pain. I'm speaking about something I know about. The people Steinbeck was observing were not chewing their food with their front teeth because it was a custom. They were chewing it. They were doing that out of necessity. And this is the case with the story of burning your cabin down in order to get the nails out. This is a misunderstanding of history that historians, once one historian writes it, the others are typically too lazy to check out the story. They just want to mimic what's already been written. They just parrot what they've already been heard. And so they squawk the same line without actually thinking it through. But what was actually happening, and this is especially true with immigrants that left Appalachia and left eastern Ohio, left eastern Kentucky, and left parts of Tennessee and moved westward, either moving into Texas or moving into the Ozarks or moving out across the prairie. The reason that those people burned their cabins, not to get the nails, the reason they burned their cabins is because land speculators, bankers, social committees, these different people moved into their areas. It was the state. The state was moving in on them. And in one way or the other, in many cases, they tricked these people into taking out loans, or they would bring in a new concept, which was called property tax. And so for generations, people living in Appalachia had no property tax. And then all of a sudden, somebody says, well, you have to pay a property tax. Well, the guy in Appalachia is like, oh, this property's been in my family for six generations. I'm not going to pay somebody else to live on my property. Well, after a few years, the sheriff comes out and serves the papers, and all of a sudden you don't own the property anymore because of something they made up and inflicted upon you called property tax. So you know what this guy does? He says, you know, if you're going to take my property and you've got the power of the guns of the government behind you, and I can't fight you on this, and my neighbors around me have all capitulated, and they're all paying this quit rent or this property tax, and I'm the only one here that's willing to stand up for my property, and why should I die for this? You know what I'll do? I'll just pack my belongings, and I'll move away from the state. I'll move out west. I'll go where a man can be left alone. I'll go out there and start over just like my great-grandfather did, or just like my great-great-grandfather did. And I'll be free of these people. And that's what was actually happening. And the last thing that they would do before they left was to light off their cabin and burn it down so that those stinking statists couldn't use it. That's why they burned their cabin down. Gathering the nails out of it was just a practical aspect of, you know, hey, why let those people have perfectly good nails? And it's metal. You don't throw away, you know, in the 1800s, you don't throw away perfectly good metal. You can remake it into all kinds of things. You get a good fire going, you can make it into horseshoes, you can make it into, you know, anything you want. So you just, as a practical term, you just don't allow, you know, you just don't leave behind perfectly good nails. You don't do that. But you also don't leave behind a perfectly good cabin for the state to take over and for those busybodies up at the county seat to now own and sell to one of their relatives really super cheap because they organized the government around you. So that's why the cabins got burned. It wasn't for the nails. Okay, I'm going to break for a commercial, so I'll be right back after this commercial break. Folks, have you seen the silver and gold trading cards from Shire Silver? You have to check these out. They're specific weights of real silver or gold laminated inside trading cards, and they're a great way to show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. And now you can buy them using bitcoins or Federal Reserve notes. Folks, you really need to check this out. Go over to Shire Silver, watch the video on the main page, check out the list of merchants that accept silver and gold trading cards, and you can even learn how you can get paid to help spread the word about Shire Silver trading cards. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break there. Before I start rambling off talking about Appalachian pioneers and so forth burning their cabins and taking the nails, before I started talking about all that, or in the midst of it or whatever, I was trying to make the point that I was trying to make a contrast between revisionist history and statist history. Some revisionist historians, actually are statists who are trying to twist the past and make the state sound more important. But typically speaking, when I'm talking about revisionist history, I'm talking about people who are willing to look back on history and try to find out what the real motivations of people were, why they acted the way that they did, and not necessarily follow the accepted storyline on that. And there are some real good revisionist historians out there. And then I'll also refer, oftentimes, I'll either say statist historians or I'll say, court historians. My intention is that put them in as low a category as possible. I've often said that the court jesters were often more truthful than the court historians. So it's important, I think, to be able to, when you look back at history, to be able to see past what you're being fed and try to examine what the real motivations were. And realize that people are pretty much the same throughout ages and throughout times. And, you know, the court historian always will attempt to paint people in a sort of a unrealistic, cartoonish fashion, exaggerated features of different kinds. Whereas if you really apply, if you really want to know why a particular person in history made the choices that they made, you think, well, what would I do in that circumstances? And you try to find out as many of the aspects of that of the circumstances as you can. And then you think, well, what would cause this person to make this decision? And why would I make a decision like that? And you begin to ask yourself these questions, and then you start to relearn how to understand history. It's quite enlightening, really. But now, So in what I was referring to there with Steinbeck, and what I was referring to with the burning of the cabins and the nail myth, I think that's important for us today in dealing with this debate between what is a libertarian, what is not a libertarian, because these people at the Cato Institute and these people like Jack Hunter and these people who are, you know, in the news all the time, proclaiming themselves to be libertarians, we have to be very careful because, you know, you have to think of times other than the one that we're living in right now. Try to think of, and to a certain extent, this is my problem with Ayn Rand. She was very selfish, and she only thought of herself and in the moment that she was living in, and the immediate surroundings around herself and how it related back to her. That was the center of her universe was her, you know. And the flaw in that is that you tend to not think of the future. And everything that I'm doing in this podcast and everything that I'm trying to do with everything that I've written on the internet about this and everything that I've tried to record, and it's not just for the people that are hearing it right now, and it's not just for my, you know, I want to get this stuff out of my brain, so I have this driving passion to get it out of my head, to say what I have to say. But at the same time, the motivation in this is that I see a little glimpse of the future, and I want desperately to share that so that there can be some preparations for what's coming towards us. So my motivation in this is, you know, it's like with the Free State Project up there in New Hampshire. One of their slogans is liberty in our lifetime. And I really support the Free State Project, and I really appreciate the work that they're doing, and I want to do whatever possible that I can, realistically and rationally. I want to do whatever I can to support what they're doing in New Hampshire. But at the same time, there's not going to be liberty in my lifetime. I know that. But I can contribute to the future so that someday, some generation in time, there will be liberty. And so that's what I'm thinking of. I'm not thinking necessarily of my audience who's listening to my podcast today, but I'm thinking of helping people so that they can train the next generation so that it can be better, so that they have a better glimpse of the truth than I have, so that they have a better, you know, a better plan on how to move towards liberty and how to deal with the state as the state comes unwound. And, you know, and this is my goal. This is my real goal in everything that I'm doing in the liberty movement. It's not for now. It's not for me. If it was just for me, I would do like those settlers. I would just light this place off and head out into the forest and disappear. But it's not for that. You know, I have children, and now I have a grandchild on the way, and it's very much my desire to leave a legacy that moves in the right direction for them and for their sake. So when I'm picking on people, Cato libertarians or Libertarian Party members or whatever, it's not because I'm this elitist that wants to separate out and have only the pure, you know, I'll have a little circle of coffee friends and we're the only ones that are right and we can all make inside jokes. And that has nothing at all to do with it. My whole goal in this is to push out what's wrong, to shine the light of truth on anything that is not truth. And in doing that, and the purpose, of course, like I just said, is for the future. It's for our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren. It's so that they can move into a freer world. And in doing that, it's absolutely necessary to point out, you know, Cato libertarians, Libertarian Party members, you may be slightly different animals, Heritage Foundation, the Republicans, even the liberals, the Democrats, you may all be different animals in a sense, but you're all watering at the same water hole. You know, if you can imagine out on the Serengeti, and there's a water hole, and if you could just observe that water hole for a while, and you would see, you know, small animals around the edge of the water hole, maybe meerkats or something like that, and you would see a little bit bigger animals and maybe insects, little smaller animals all around the waterhole, all living on the same water supply. And you would see maybe a wildebeest come by, or maybe even a small herd of wildebeest come by. And you would also see lions laying around, and they all drink from the same waterhole. They may be very different from each other. They may be directly opposed to each other. They may even feed off of each other, but they're all drinking from that same waterhole. And in the case with Cato libertarians, Libertarian Party members, Ron Paul supporters, Heritage Foundation supporters, Heritage Foundation conservatives, Republicans, liberals, Democrats, Green Party members, all these people are all depending on the same waterhole. And that waterhole is the myth of the state, held up by the aggression, and that's really the core problem. Anybody who looks to the government to fix itself, or looks to the government to make things better, or looks to the government to somehow repair government and make government more friendly, or they want to return to a fantasy history that never really existed, where the government controlled itself and the government was good and the government did only benevolent things. Never mind the fact that never existed. People who live in that fantasy and who believe this myth, they're all watering at the same watering hole. They're the ones who want to, raise taxes on the rich and give more welfare to the poor. It's the same watering hole as the guy who wants to cut taxes to the rich and cut, welfare payments to the poor. But they're all still at the same watering hole because they all believe in the state and they all want to use the aggression of the state to get what they want. And it doesn't matter what kind of label they put on themselves, and it doesn't matter, how they want to formulate their magic words and what kind of games they want to play. If deep inside, their goal is to use government to get the things they want, then they're thieves. They're just thieves. The watering hole they're around is dishonesty. They lie to themselves. They lie to each other. They pretend what they do is good. This is all part of the religion of the state. The second you accept in your mind that aggression, under any circumstances, can never produce good, when you realize in your head that a system based on aggression is evil, when that moment comes and you realize that the government is nothing but a gang of thieves, that's all they are. And it doesn't matter if they smile nice or if they have good hair or if their skin tone is the right color that makes you happy, or if they have just the right accent, or if they wear a cowboy hat, or if they're, none of those things matter. If it's their desire to use the aggression of government for any purpose, then they're all watering at the same watering hole. They are all thieves. They are all our enemies. They are the enemies of freedom. They are the enemies of liberty. And they are the enemies of libertarians. And some people say, well, that's very, very divisive of you. You need to have a big tent philosophy. No, they have the big tent philosophy. They are the ones who want to set morals aside and not really think about the morality of what they're doing. That's all of those people. The most dedicated liberal in the world might have good intentions. They might think, this is how we have a better world. This is how we save the poor. This is how we feed the hungry, by robbing other people and taking that money and go feeding them. But really, that's exactly what the conservative is saying. When the conservative starts defending the highway programs, or when the conservative starts defending the huge bloated military-industrial complex, all he's really saying is, I'm willing to rob some people to get what I want. That's all he's really saying. And when the Cato libertarians, when they start talking about, well, if we can stimulate the economy by lowering taxes by this amount, and then we'll produce a greater income for the government because lower taxes stimulates the economy and in the long run brings in more taxes, you're at the same watering hole as the liberal and the conservative. you're still wanting to rip people off. You're still wanting to rob people to get the things you want. To have the things you want to steal it from somebody else. Unless, in your mind, you can reject the aggression of the state and realize that theft is theft, and there is no little bit of theft that's acceptable, you're still watering at the same hole until you can grasp that in your mind. Now, at this point, the Cato or the Libertarian Party type libertarian might be saying, look, you need to be realistic. This is the world we live in. What we need to do is nudge the system. We'll have a slightly better life. It's okay to vote because it's an act of self-defense. We're trying to make the government smaller as an act of self-defense. And what we, you know, and sometimes they'll use a metaphor of a car, and they'll say, you know, what we need to do is just nudge this a little bit and just kind of slightly change the direction of this vehicle and make sure it goes down this road and not that road, or it goes in this direction and not that direction. But all of that is wrong. All that whole system, every aspect of it that depends on the aggression of government, is entirely evil. It is not salvageable. It's not a car going down the highway. It's not something you can nudge a bit, nudge 5% to the side and maybe get something a little bit better. Here's something for you. I'm going to quote someone who you will rarely hear me quoting this person. But John F. Kennedy said, in reference to the Berlin Wall, he said, "The freedom of the city is not negotiable. We cannot negotiate with those who say what's mine is mine, and what's yours is negotiable." I'm going to read that again. This is from John F. Kennedy referring to the Berlin Wall and the isolation of Berlin. He said, "The freedom of the city is not negotiable. We cannot negotiate with those who say what's mine is mine, and what's yours is negotiable." Now, if I were writing that for Kennedy, I would not have put the word negotiable three times in two sentences. That's not a good writing technique. But knowing how Kennedy, knowing how Kennedy messed up his lines pretty regularly, especially in reference to Berlin, it probably wasn't written for him like that, or it's just something that popped into his head. But his point is, you can't negotiate with somebody who says what's mine is mine, and what's yours, I might steal some of if I feel like it. You can't negotiate with somebody like that. And that's what we're dealing with the state and with statists, people who support the state. What's mine is mine, and what's yours is yours. And if we can't come to an agreement on that one central point, that theft has to stop, respect of property is primary. You cannot have a zero aggression principle without respect of property. And you cannot have respect of property without the zero aggression principle. And you cannot obtain liberty without the zero aggression principle and respect for property. And any compromise upon the zero aggression principle and property rights means no liberty is possible. So you cannot negotiate with a thief about how much is good for him to steal from you. You cannot negotiate with someone who is willing to use aggression against you to take what is yours. What you need to do is expose their aggression. And if you have to expose that to them, if you can expose their aggression back to them and change their mind and change their heart with it, then that's great. But one way or the other, you can't accept aggression, theft, lies. You can't accept these things and say, well, it's okay. I've been picking on separate people here lately, but I got a lot of heat because of the thing with Mark Stevens, and I got a lot of heat from the thing where I talked about Gary Johnson. But both of these two people, both of which call themselves libertarians, both of them, and I pointed this out in both cases, and even using the recordings of them saying it with their own mouths, in both cases what we're talking about is people who openly lied. As long as a person is willing to stand there and just lie right to your face, he is not someone you can negotiate with. He's not trustworthy. You really have no common ground with him. That's about all I can fit into today's podcast. So I hate to leave it on a negative note like that. But sometimes we have to really face the reality of what we're dealing with. And we are dealing with infiltrators, like I talked about the other day. And we really are dealing with people who are embracing evil. And that can't be whitewashed. You can't just, you know, put some vanilla coating on it and assume that it's going to be okay. Lies are evil. It's a poison we can't allow into our system. Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you very much for